4:55 on October 14th. Okay. I've been struggling here with the projector, but it's working now. So I thought we should talk through the project a bit before we continue to talk about broadcast and multicast. Has everybody had a chance to look at the project? Anybody not had a chance to look at the project? Some. Okay. So those who have looked at it, please feel free to bring your questions forward at this point. That will help people who haven't had a chance to look at it either. So this is doing distance vector routing, and the idea is to just sort of see how it evolves and see how it's controlled, and also get some practice using socket programming, now adding with it the idea of doing a select system call as well as everything else that we've talked about for doing application level demultiplexing. So let's talk about that. The idea is that in a C program, you get to a certain point and you want to say, I need to be able to receive a message from that socket or that socket or that socket or that file descriptor or wait for a timeout. Okay? That's the idea that's going on with select. And that essentially is demultiplexing the point at which the select calls, right? You have all these different things coming in at that point, and you have to choose which one of them happened and then do the appropriate thing. So that's a kind of application level demultiplexing. We'll talk about that as we go through here. But that's the purpose. You'll be turning in something in C, C++, or Python. Since the point of the project is to use select, I'm not going to let you use threads in Java or even threads in Python to do this. You have to figure out how to use select to do this in a single threaded programming situation. But if you have different ideas about how you want to do that, then come see me and that's fine. We can figure out what you can do. I have provided some skeleton code for C and for Python that will read some of the inputs you need to read, so you don't have to do that. But anyway, any questions about that part? Okay, as usual, you're going to be turning in a zip or tar file that contains your code, yes, checking to make sure that's really there. The output of that code running on some test cases that are supplied. There's what I call a comments file, which is a write-up of this experiment, essentially, and we'll talk about that. Some way to build your code into executable programs, for Python, that's probably shell scripts to just run them, but something. And the instructions for building and running your code. So that's what you got to turn in because Vic has got to sort of look at these things and figure out how to make them run as well as being able to talk to you. Okay, and then like last time, after you turn them in, you'll talk with Vic about what they are and show them what's going on. Okay. So you're implementing distance vector. You're going to actually have different processes running that represent the different routers associated with that. And the network specification is very simple. It just consists of a set of routers, a set of links, and the costs of the links. And so we'll iterate over that. Okay, so how does it get its configuration? It reads it from from files. Let's see. Yes. So there's a configuration file called routers that specifies the names of the routers and where they run, what port number, and so forth. This is necessary for the routers to actually set up the communication between each other. And then each router itself has a configuration file that has its own link information in it. So, anyway, you can edit those. You don't have to use them just as they are. Okay, just this was a point of confusion last time we did that. There's a file named links in the test directories as well. It's not actually used directly in your routers, but rather is used to generate those other files. And so there's a script later that can use that file named links to generate all those other files that are needed. But your program doesn't read those. Okay, so the thing that's linked on the web page for this is a zip file containing all this stuff. So, here's the thing. Remember that the way distance vector routing works is that the neighbor routers send their routing information to each of their neighbors, saying how much it costs to get from me, how much it costs to get from me to a certain destination. And I've simplified this in that rather than sending the whole vector in one message, there's a message per destination. So you just send one destination at a time to your neighbors. Okay, and you say what the destination is, what the cost is. Okay, the neighbor, when it gets that, processes it and updates its own routing table and potentially sends out an update on its own. If you want to ensure that there's a new line at the end of that, that would be fine. Just so you know where it ends, or that it's null terminated, that's the kind of decision that you can make. I'm not going to make your code operate with anybody else's. So you can decide on that convention. Or if you want to send, actually sending the length ahead of it is not a good idea, because you want to actually be able to drive this process sometimes from a terminal. Okay, and typing in binary lengths of things is hard. So it's better to use a terminator in this case. Okay. So those are the update messages. They propagate between routers. Then there are some management messages. These in particular get sent from the terminal. And they look like the letter L followed by a link number and the new cost of that link. Okay, so we won't add links this way, but we'll change their cost, and we can change them to infinity. Somewhere I said what I think infinity should be. Did it say 16? 64. Okay, so counting to infinity can take a while, but all right. Okay, so we're not implementing Poisson reverse. And there's some specifications about what messages should be printed when things change. Straightforward. Finally, there's a command that can be sent to the router from a terminal by typing in the letter P and some destination, and at that point the router is supposed to print a message that says what the distance is to that destination. And if you don't supply a D, then print the whole routing, whole current routing table. Okay, now, the way this is going to go is that we're going to use a seldom used, but not never used, feature of sockets called connected datagram sockets. You remember that in using UDP sockets, we used the send message and receive message system calls that included the destination, and in the case of send, and the receive message in the case of receive, that lets you send to sort of any destination and receive from any destination with those system calls. And we did not use the connect system call in particular. So this other way of using datagram sockets is called connected datagram sockets. And what you do is you say, once you've got your socket and you've got it bound, you can say connect that socket to some other specific destination and IP address and port number. Okay? After you do that, that socket can only send to that destination and only receive from that destination. Okay? This will be handy because we're going to have a whole bunch of these sockets, one talking to each of the neighbor routers, and by doing this, you're assured that any messages you get on that socket actually came from the place it was supposed to come from, and any message you send goes to the right place. So if you can get the connected socket set up right, then things should be more straightforward later. All right. And the code that I've supplied actually builds up a set of connected sockets for you. So the main thing you got to realize that is each connected socket only talks to one particular destination, only gets messages from one particular destination. We'll also use an unconnected datagram socket that is sort of the lowest numbered socket being used in this process to receive the L and P messages, which are sort of commands that you want to be able to send at this thing from any source. So L stands for link update, P for print, and U for update. Okay. So, like I said earlier, the idea here is that all of this can happen sort of at random times, right? You can get it. The next message you're going to get can come from any of your neighbors, or it could come from a command being sent to you from the command line. And so you need some mechanism to be able to receive any of those messages. If you just said receive, what would happen? You'd have to specify which socket it was that was going to provide the next message. Well, that won't do. We have to be able to select, we have to be able to get a message from any of them. So I think I owe you a lecture on using select. It's described in the Pocket Guide. We'll spend some time next time talking about how select works. Basically, it takes sets of file descriptors as its arguments, a set for descriptors that have become ready for reading, a set that have become ready for writing, a set that have had errors on them, as well as a timeout. And whichever one of those things happens first, it returns you information that tells you what you have to do. Okay? Finally, I suggest that you write some shell scripts for starting all this stuff up. If you try to start them all by hand, you know, once you get up to 4 or 6 or 16 programs to run for every test that you want to do, you'll spend all your time typing. So develop shell scripts to do that. If you run on the lab machines, I don't think anybody is, but if you do, make sure that you kill any running processes before you leave. And even on your own machine, it's important to have the ability to kill off all of those processes, because the next time you try to run it, you're going to get port already in use issues if you don't. So again, some shell scripts that will kill off everything related to this project would be a good idea. Okay? Does that agree with what you've interpreted so far? Did I say anything that conflicted with your prior interpretation? That would be interesting. No. Okay. All right. So this is due after the exam. Again, I think that like for the first exam, getting some significant progress on this before the exam is a really good idea, because you'll gain insight into how this works that you just don't quite get from doing it by hand. Always been my experience. Any other questions? Okay, then I want to talk the remainder of the time about broadcast and multicast. So, I mean, the book doesn't ever actually come out and say this, but the reason we talk about broadcast here is not because broadcast is very interesting in the internet, but because broadcast is a simplified model of multicast that's easier to talk about. So we'll talk about broadcast briefly, but just know that broadcast is not sort of the ultimate goal here. It's multicast. So, broadcast. The idea is to deliver, sort of at the network layer, packets that are sourced at one point in the network to everywhere else. Okay? And you could think about doing that by having the source sort of send that message to every other node, right? Using unicast. So iterate through all the other nodes in the network, sending it to each one of them. Probably not a good idea. Couple of reasons. One is it just takes a long time, right? You're making this, and it uses resources badly. You're making the same message go over the network one time after another. And there's really no point of it. If the message already got to the other end of a link, why not make use of the fact that it's already there to send it where it needs to go? The other problem is that the source may not actually know the addresses of all the destinations. Right? We want to send to the whole internet. Well, what is the whole internet? The source is not going to know that. So the idea of broadcast is to provide a service in the network of delivering packets to multiple locations. So how does that then get implemented? The basic idea is that when a node, in this case a router, receives what claims to be a broadcast packet, it forwards it to everybody in all of its local connections. Okay? This is called flooding. right? Because think about what it would look like in a network. Excuse me. What it would look like in a network, a message would start at one point in the network, and it would, in one time period, go out a little ways, and in the next time period, it would go a little farther and a little farther and a little farther, and it would sort of look like the Great Montana Flood. After a while, it would just be washing over the entire network. The problem that arises there is that, you know, in that simple-minded description of things, think about what happens when a network lives on a cycle in the network. So, let's do this. We'll start here. Suppose our network looks like that. If the rule is simply forward every packet you receive to all of your neighbors, what happens? Well, we start here, we forward it there, we forward to both neighbors forward to there, and then it just, okay. So it just keeps cycling around the cycle in both directions. You know, continuing to use up resources, and you've already seen it. So you have to control the flooding. And there are a couple of schemes for doing that that are sort of widely used. Excuse me. A couple of schemes that are widely used. One is the sort of obvious thing that if you've seen the packet before, don't forward it. You already forwarded it once, don't forward it again. The problem there is, of course, you have to keep track of everything you've seen. And that means keeping a lot of state associated with the broadcasts, and also having to look up things in that state so it can get slow. So that's one idea of how to do it. The other idea that is commonly implemented is called reverse path forwarding, and that this is going to come up multiple times here. So let's do our example again here. The idea of reverse path forwarding is when you receive a broadcast, you say, did I get it on the shortest get it on the link that lies on the shortest path from me back to the source? Okay, you see that? So in the case of this node here, there are of course lots of paths from me back to the source. Some of them come back to me again, but the shortest one is just the one that goes on that link back to the source. I say, yes, I did get it on that shortest, that link that is on the shortest path. And so in that case, I will forward it. All right. So I go ahead and forward it. Both of these guys say, did I get it on the shortest path from me to the source? Yes, I did. So I will forward it.
So they do.
But now things stop because neither of these gets that second message on the one link that is allowed to send, that they will forward from. Okay? Okay. So, reverse path forwarding is pretty neat, and you could implement broadcast that way, but notice that every message that is broadcast actually traverses some lengths multiple times. Right? It doesn't ever get into a cycle, but we waste some bandwidth sending these messages to nodes that have already gotten them. And so we can improve on this by saying, let's figure out a spanning tree for this network.
Now, try that one more time, but get some blue ink.
So, what is a spanning tree? Remember this from 223?
Spanning tree is a subset of the nodes, of the edges of a graph that connects all of the nodes without cycles.
Okay, so in our example here, we could do a spanning tree that looked like this, of course, but we could also do one that looked like that. All right? And there's a symmetric one going the other way. So it's a subset of the edges. It connects all the nodes. Now the rule is
trying to find a safe way to scroll this because
it seems to want to scroll excessively. So now the rule is forward copies only on the spanning tree edges. So if there's a situation like this, if we're using the purple spanning tree here, we'd forward to the second node, we'd forward there, and then we'd forward over here. Okay? And so it would never get forwarded back around the cycle because that edge is not part of the spanning tree. So, how do you create a spanning tree? Well, one way is to use the do I have a slide about this? Yeah. One way to create a spanning tree would be to sort of run a preliminary phase of broadcast using RPF, say. Right? And keep track of which messages were received for the first time. And include those edges. And we'll see some multicast algorithms later that do it that way. Another way to do it is to identify some node that needs to be in that tree, some specific node. Well, I guess in the case of broadcast, every node will be in the tree. So we identify one node as the so-called center node.
We just say it's special.
Okay? And then every other node sends a unicast message to that node and records the path.
until it hits the spanning tree.
Okay, so I don't know, this is kind of fuzzy. There are some numbers on here. It's very fuzzy. Suppose we choose E as our center node. And F wants to join next. F is this node here. It just simply says, send a message to E and the edges in the path that that message take become part of the spanning tree. The next one to join might be B. So this is the first joiner, the second joiner is B. Its message goes like so. And those two edges become part of the spanning tree. If A then joins, its message might go that way. If it does, that edge becomes part of the spanning tree. Suppose it didn't. Suppose A's message went this way, then those two edges would be part of the spanning tree. And then when B joins, B is already joined, who needs to join? G? Okay, I think we have a spanning tree. Anyway, see how that works? So you just say, send a message toward that center and take the union of the edges that you get in doing that. So my spanning tree is different than the one they figured out because I had A join in a different way. But you get a spanning tree. Okay, so once you have a spanning tree, by whatever means, when you send a broadcast message, you can follow the rule that you only send on spanning tree edges, and then there are no cycles, there's no repetition. Questions about this? Okay. I've really got to get the AV facilities people in here to tune up this projector because this is really hard to look at. How bad is it to look at for you guys?
I can't read it.
Can't read it at all? Yeah.
I mean, I have to say, I read big ones.
Yeah. The fact that the colors are all separated is not great. Okay, so that's sort of the principles about all this that we get from thinking about broadcast. But practically speaking, we don't want a broadcast. We want to rather send messages to a relatively small subset of the nodes that exist in the internet. But we still don't want to have to resend to each destination because although it's relatively small, right, the internet is some billions of hosts, sort of anything under 100 million is a small subset, a proportionally small subset, but it's still a huge number of nodes, right? So you don't want to be sending 100 million messages to reach all of these guys. So multicast then is the idea of reach a subset of the nodes. And the multicast routing problem is to come up with a tree that spans just the routers that have actual subscribers to the multicast group. We don't want to include routers that don't have any use for this information. So we're not looking for a broadcast spanning tree anymore. We're looking for a subset of that. But the same idea can be applied that we used for the broadcast tree. We can use flooding to create the tree using RPF, or we can create the tree by this technique of tracing the routes toward the center. So in the internet, there's a role for both what are called source-based multicast trees, which means that every source sending to a group has its own tree, and so-called shared trees, where there's one tree that's used by all senders to a group. And the usual assumption is that the sender, that someone who wants to send to a group is also a member of the group. So for source-based trees, reverse path forwarding works well because what you get is the shortest overall tree. So this is a minimum cost tree. It's the shortest path to it. It contains the shortest path to each destination. Now that's kind of nice because that says the messages will get to the destinations fast. Yeah.
So when you're creating these paths, does that mean that the other ones that aren't used aren't utilized? Or, like, so one node has multiple paths.
Not usually. Right. It's like with the other routing that we talked about, having routing be sensitive to costs in the short term leads to routing instability. And so generally people sort of ignore that as an issue. So this is a consequence of using what's called reverse path. Using reverse path forwarding will get you a minimum cost tree. Well, if you know all about your network, and you know, that is, if you know the topology of the network, you know how it's connected and the costs of all the links, you can easily use an algorithm that's closely related to Dijkstra's algorithm to find shortest paths to all the destinations. But of course, we really want to do this in a distributed fashion. So, well, he doesn't actually. Yeah, that's right. So there really isn't a need to do this, to run this centralized algorithm. You can take advantage of what you already did, we said this, and use reverse path forwarding. That will get you the minimum cost path to everywhere. Now, it does have, we're constructing a tree. So this is reverse path forwarding used to construct the spanning tree. Notice that while constructing the spanning tree, we actually send some redundant traffic over these links. Right? That's the way reverse path forwarding works. You send to somebody and they say, no, I have a different way of getting that. And so it ignores that message. But once you've done that process of constructing the spanning tree, you no longer have to send those extra messages. So that's what I said before. So one problem here about this is that it's done without any knowledge of who the subscribers are for this multicast. Right? There's nothing in this that says, I know where this needs to go. So you're sort of faced with building a multicast spanning tree that spans the entire internet, say. And we would continue to forward traffic to routers that had no interest in it. I think that's on this next slide. So R5 here and R7 would be getting all the traffic that was associated with this multicast tree. This in the early version of multicast for the internet, this happened, but people realized that was silly. So what you do is, this is an interesting process. Rather than say, oh, let's try to figure out where all the subscribers are before we do this, we say, we'll figure out where all the subscribers are after we do this. So we actually build the multicast spanning tree, and the routers then say, well, I don't care about that. I don't care about that multicast group. I have no subscribers for it. So I tell the person upstream of me in the spanning tree, I have no interest in that. They say, well, he doesn't, and I don't have any local subscribers either, so I'll tell my upstream router, I don't have any interest. At some point, you reach a router that says, oh yeah, I have a local client, and I need to be in the spanning tree. So this is the process of pruning, right? So you build a big tree, and then you sort of undo it. This is actually an interesting point as well. The theory here, we're going to talk about the actuality in a few moments, but the theory here is sort of nice, right? You think of, oh, we want to build this shortest path tree, all well and good. But in the internet, what really goes on is that hosts come and go, right? Nothing's permanent here. And so what we really need is algorithms that adaptively adjust the tree to who's present and who's not. And pruning turns out to be sort of one of the algorithms that is important then for adjusting the spanning tree when people go. Right? Even if they were there a while ago, maybe they're not there now, we want to get rid of the traffic associated with them. Okay, so for center-based trees, that is, trees that for shared trees, let me say this way. For shared trees, a tree that is used by all the senders to reach the multicast group recipients, a better choice is what's known as a Steiner tree, which is the tree that has the minimum sum of link costs. Okay? Which is not the same thing as the one we got for the other one, which had the minimum path to each destination. made sense if we were only using it from a single sender, but now if we're using it from multiple senders, we can't optimize that for all senders simultaneously. So better choice might seem to be the spanning tree that has minimum cost. Well, unfortunately, this is a so-called NP-complete problem. Even in a centralized setting, it is extremely costly to compute. Because basically, to maintain optimality in the face of changes means sort of recomputing the entire tree every time. So instead, we'll just fall back on the center-based tree, which we described how to build previously. And so there's another example of that. Internet multicast routing, the distance vector multicast routing protocol, sort of extends the distance vector ideas using flood and prune, like we talked about. I don't think there's anything terribly interesting there. Yeah, it's just a sort of a direct application of the theoretical discussion to the internet, with the idea of also having prune. There's one thing on this slide that I want to point out. So, like I said, the nodes come and go from multicast groups. We need to have management associated with that process, right? Somehow there has to be a protocol by which a node can tell a router, yes, I want to be in a multicast group. Okay, that's called IGMP, the Internet Gateway Multicast Protocol. Not to be confused with IGP, an Interior Gateway Protocol. Internet Gateway Multicast Protocol. I hope I said that right. I get confused. The idea here is that hosts interact with gateways, okay, to say what they want to be into, what groups they want to be into, and then the routers execute the sort of internet level protocols to join groups or leave groups using prune messages. The early multicast in the internet was carried out over something called the M-bone, the multicast backbone. It was a collection of routers that did that knew how to do multicast. Say the square ones know how to do multicast, and the other ones don't. And the idea was that you had actually used tunneling to create virtual links between the multicast aware routers. So we talked about tunneling before, right? That you can do multicast in the internet even when the internet doesn't know anything about multicast, by having a collection of routers that do know about it and hooking them together with TCP tunnels. Well, maybe not TCP, with tunnels. Oh, there it is, tunneling. Next slide. We talked about it for IP version 6. I think that's all I want to say about broadcast and multicast. Next time, we'll talk about select, programming with select. And I think that wraps up this chapter. So we will start into the link layer as well next time. Okay? So please look at this. And if you have questions about this, next time would be a really good time to raise them, because we're going to be moving on from here. Thanks.